Welcome to Splatbook, the RPG Topics podcast. If this is your first episode, we talk about tabletop RPG design. This show is brought to you by the generous contributions of the lovely backers of the MapCrow Patreon. Head on over to patreon.com/MapCrow and pledge today to support the show and gain exclusive access to the MapCrow Secret Sketchbook. My name is Kyle, and today with me is my favorite thousand-year-old sorcerer who is threatened by my vaguely more progressive politics, John. John, how are you doing today?
If it isn't the last defender of Camelot, Kyle Lancelotino.
Ooh, I like how you worked that in. Oh my yes. goodness. What so are we talking about today, John?
Yeah, we're talking about this story that we mentioned last week. It's a story by Roger Zelazny called The Last Defender of Camelot. And we're going to sort of get into it and how it inspired me in my personal Appendix N and how it might be gameable. But we just throw that in because we're only allegedly a gaming podcast at this point. But
it's true. You
know, we'll do our best. The only reason this podcast isn't called John and Kyle Talk About Stuff is that that name is already taken by Ken and Robin. So we just, you know.
It's true.
It's 100% true. So, so I picked this one. It was my turn to pick. And it is different than the other stories we've read in a lot of ways.
Yes.
How do you want to start? Yeah, go ahead.
I want to introduce this with the thing that has been troubling me ever since I read it.
Yeah, please.
Which is, why in heaven's name did you choose this as part of your appendix? And what could this story possibly have to do with, like, how you run games?
Yeah, and
that kind of thing. Because I'm sure there's a way. I just can't see it.
Yeah, well, I can more answer that question in terms of, I will give you one quick answer, which is that unlike Carl Edward Wagner or Lord Dunsany or Dunsany or however we want to say it, mm-hmm. what Roger Zelazny has is a sense of humor. And in regards to all of this, so if we take Lord Dunsany and Carl Edward Wagner as the purveyors of earnest myth that they are.
Okay. Yeah.
Roger Zelazny becomes kind of its deconstructor, right? So he is Roger Zelazny is to Carl Edward Wagner as Alan Moore is to Frank Miller. Right? Like Alan, like that face, like for all of its sort of deconstructionism and changing of the Dark Knight, the Dark Knight Returns, the comic book, is a very earnest story. Like, I feel that Frank Miller earnestly believes what he's writing there. Whereas,
oh yes,
the Watchmen is a clear deconstruction from somebody who is kind of tired of superheroes and wants to pull the hood back, the cape back a little bit, and say, look, here's what's really underneath. How do you like
that? You've hooked me. That is, because originally, just as a short tangent, I have always considered, you know, Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen to be like basically having the different conversation.
Right.
But no, like I really do now see what you mean. And I like pulling those apart in that way is it's a very compelling argument. And
yeah. And you could say they both, you know, Batman was very different before The Dark Knight Returns, I think. And so it really did remake Batman in a lot of ways. But at the same time, wow, this is not where I was expecting to go today. But at the same time, I know we don't like to talk about intention too much because in some extent, author intention doesn't matter, right? We've had this conversation. Right. But I would argue, if you compared it to like the sequel to Dark Knight Returns, which is very sort of glib and wry and wink, wink at the camera. I can't even tell you anything about it. It's not, you know, nearly as good as the original. But I feel that The Dark Knight Returns is the culmination of Frank Miller's very earnest love of libertarianism and noir stories and Batman, right? And he it's all in there in a very serious way. Whereas I think that Watchmen is the exact opposite from an intention standpoint. I want to pull them apart. I'm so tired of superheroes. I want to pull them apart and show them for the silly idiots they are.
We have to move on because I really want to just like keep talking about this you're setting my brain on fire.
I'm sorry. Well, that's good, right? Let me give you another analogy that'll help us move away. So if we think of, actually, this is an analogy I came up with this morning. If we think of like my influences, and I know this is a totally self-centered view of a bunch of people who are
it's
dead.
It's our podcast. This is nothing but self-centering ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. If all my favorite authors, right, are like a band, they're the Beatles, right? Have you ever heard the expression, Paul McCartney is the heart of the Beatles and John Lennon is the head, right? So Carl Edward Wagner is the heart of my personal pantheon, and Roger Zelazny is the more cerebral, intellectual head of my personal pantheon of writers.
Your structures for how you are approaching fiction become more compelling by the moment. And I have never been more happy that we have a podcast to talk about this
than you are right now.
Yeah, I am gleeful, positively gleeful.
Well, let me say two more things. First of all, that analogy led me to a joke. So if Roger Zelazny is John Lennon and Carl Edward Wagner is Paul McCartney, I think that makes Michael Moorcock Ringo, which... He's Andy, still going. I'm just saying. He's the one who's still going. He's still here. He's got an Elric novel coming out next year. Like, just consistent. He can keep a beat, man. I'm just saying.
Andy just spit out his beverage and just, like, painted his study wall with whatever he was just now sipping.
That,
so
now that Andy and I are no longer friends. We can. I want to say something else about why I picked this story. I picked it because it's the one that occurred to me. He has a lot of stories, and if I could get you to read more of them, I would. He has a story called The Doors of His Face, The Lamps of His Mouth. Like, he has a, like, it, he is, I do not think, I think that fantasy literature and sort of literature are just different genres, but he is an author who tries to push fantasy a little bit more towards the literature side of
sure.
things.
Sure. And the distinction that I've always heard
so much, but
The terms I've always heard is like literary fiction versus genre fiction.
Yeah.
And he's kind of like pulling genre fiction sort of more literary.
Yes. Now, if you were to ask Pat Rothfuss of The Name of the Wind fame, he would say, you know, literary fiction is just another genre of genre fiction. And you and I are not going to win that fight with anybody today, but
certainly not.
I think Zelazny wanted to become a writer and chose fantasy and science fiction. Whereas I don't think Carl Edward Wagner ever had a choice. He was a horror fantasy author and there was nothing he could do about it.
So. That's really interesting. Wow.
Yeah, sorry. Maybe we should actually talk about the actual story that we...
you really absolutely need to. When I asked you the question, why did you pick this for the appendix N, this is some of the most thoughtful stuff. And I also recognize that, you know, the stipulation of making it a short story really precludes a lot of the stuff that you would want to represent your chosen authors. Nonetheless,
if I could pick anything, it would be Nine Princes in Amber, the first Amber novel, which I think is just a perfect fantasy novel. That'll allow me to expound, but let's talk about the actual story, and then we can come back to all that.
Right.
Some thoughts about why I like Zelazny in this way. I don't know if this is in your edition. I'm just going to mention it really quick because it's something I really enjoy about Roger Zelazny. The edition that you have is a sort of random collection of his short stories from across his career, whereas the edition I have is a collection of stories from a time period. And he published like five collections of short stories. He was mostly a short story writer. And we can, like we did last time, we can talk to him. But
published in like Isaac Asimov's, sci-fi magazine issue.
This is back in the day when a fantasy writer could still make $500 for getting a story. And that meant, and that was a lot of money. Right.
Yeah.
Like he wasn't a millionaire by any stretch, but he lived okay.
That kind of training ground for emerging writers to kind of make a living and then kind of get novel deals. No, that pipeline no longer exists. It's been completely dismantled and has been for decades.
Yes, and he was part of that. You know, the most famous person to come from that system is Stephen King, right? He notoriously wrote stories for $20 in pornographic magazines, and now he is the best-selling author of the year again because of his new book, Fairy Tale. So, you know, like, that pipeline no longer exists. But one thing I liked about these collections is he would always write intros about the work. He always says, it's contrary to my general practice to introduce my own works, but he does it every time. And it's so hilarious. But to give you a sense of the sense of humor, at the introduction to Just the Last Defender of Camelot, here's how he introduces the story. I wrote this one for the Saturday Evening Post, and they asked me to cut it to 4,500 words. It is 9,000 words in length. Crossing out every other word made it sound funny, so I didn't do it. Like, and that, like, that just sort of, like, he's so sort of literal and practical in a way that just makes me laugh, that I really
That's
enjoy.
That's marvelous.
So, yeah. In another introduction to another story, he says he got solicited to write a story from some other major publication. I can't remember what it was. The woman found one of his books in the bookstore, and he said, I wonder if she'd entered at the other end of the rack under A instead of Z, if she would have called somebody else. Like, so, all right, let's set aside Zelazny and all those sort of future thoughts, and let's just talk about the story. What is it? So,
can we very quickly, can I try to speed run the summary of it?
Yeah, please. Because right. I'll get lost. I like all the bits so much, but go for it.
Guy gets mugged in San Francisco, beats up the muggers. Guy turns out to be an immortal Lancelot who has been alive
from
since
the
days
the Arthur
of Arthur
myth. Yep.
Yes. And then happens to meet a fortune teller who is Morgan Le Fay, who has also survived from Arthurian times. They find out together that Merlin is waking up. So Lancelot,
he didn't die. He was put under enchantment that didn't kill him or make him go to sleep forever. It just made him go to sleep for a really long time.
You're making my speed run very difficult.
Sorry,
with all
go ahead. Sorry, I'm done. Done.
And so Lancelot goes to help Merlin wake up, help his old friend out of this 1,000-year slumber. And he does that. They find him, and Merlin wakes up, and he's just like, oh, hey, how's the world? What's going on? And Lancelot's like, the world's kind of better and worse. War still exists. And Merlin's like, well, hey, we have to impose our order. Let's get the gang together and, like, you know, fix all the problems with the world. And Lancelot's like, no, we should actually just let people do what they want. Solve cannot be solved. And right. So Merlin's just like, oh, so you're a traitor. You're a pacifist now. And basically tries to betray and kill Lancelot and sacrifice him to complete the culmination of the reawakening of his powers. This is Merlin. And then there's this big tournament. There's this big, like, fight between Merlin's champion and Lancelot, and they fight and they all die, and that's the end of the story.
That's the end of the story. Yes.
So that is, you know, that is to be glib, but if you hadn't read it, that is the basics of what happens in the story. But the strength of this is not in the outline. It's not actually the plot. The progression of events is not very interesting. It is hearing all of these different characters, various characters kind of comment on, you know, how the passage of time has changed their stories and changed their points of view on things. And Merlin kind of emerging in a contemporary dialogue from 1,000 years ago, where the last memory he had was, like, at the end of Camelot, basically. Right. And what it's like, he's no longer, like, welcome. Like, his once utopian sounding plans are now just, like, sort of like the most horrific, you know, magical fascism you could imagine.
It's a utopian idealist who emerges in a world that emerges into a complex modern world, but refuses to believe that it's really that complex.
Yes.
And thinks that his quote, and that, you know, simple morality can win the day. that he can use strength to impose his will on the world. Yeah.
And it's an amazing thesis with some truly memorable lines in it. And so we've introduced it. We've kind of talked about we kind of spoiled the big takeaways. So you don't actually have to encounter the art yourself and come to your own conclusions. We're telling good. What to think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just
but
do
I,
what we
I
say, like Merlin waking up from a 1,000-year slumber, just do what we say and everything will be fine.
Yeah, absolutely. But John, yeah, I would love to hear you just kind of like, yeah, just all of this, all of your thoughts, just hit me with them. I think you're on fire and I can't wait for this.
Well, there's some wonderful bits in this story, and I think it hits me very differently as a middle-aged man than it did as a young man. As a young man, for example, the bit at the beginning is kind of great. Like we had this conversation about the Dark Muse. I love me some written action, and you could do without it. But when Lancelot at the beginning is confronted by the muggers, and he sort of grabs his walking stick and beats the snot out of him, you know, he later boasts. I forget whether it's Morgan or Merlin. Like, you know, still undefeated. Like, yeah. I've never lost and I never can lose. And what he's been doing, what Lancelot has been doing this whole time, is wandering the world looking for the Grail. What he's done is become an art appraiser because he feels that's the easiest, like, that's how he can do it now. Rather than fight duels and go on quests, he's like, I'll just immerse myself in the world of art. And archaeology, and if the Grail ever surfaces, I'll know. And so that's how Lancelot has been spending his time. And he feels that he has been cursed to immortality for betraying Arthur by having an affair with Guinevere. And I think the first pivotal part of the story is when he runs into Morgana and she says, look, Arthur forgave you a long time ago. He understood what was happening. He didn't really care, and your immortality is not because you betrayed your friend. And rather than being relieved, how does Lancelot react?
Like he hates it. Yeah, he hates it.
He almost leaves. He grabs his walking stick and he's going to walk out the door. And Morgana says to him, "This is one of my favorite bits." He rose to his feet and began to pace. The cat, alarmed, sprang from the sofa and ran into the back room. Lancelot stooped and snatched up his walking stick. He started for the door. I suppose it was worth waiting 1,000 years to see you afraid, she said. He halted. That is unfair. I know, but will you come back and sit down? So there's this moment where basically Lancelot in middle age, essentially, has realized that everything he's thought about the world isn't correct. And rather than face it, he wants to flee it. And Morgana sort of makes him, look, sit down, let's work it out. And he decides, he doesn't know what's going on, but he decides to go back to England and see if he can figure out what's happening. But that moment of his unraveling, of his changing of the understanding of the world, I think is great. And then he goes back and he finds Merlin asleep in a cave. There's a bit where he's like been looking for Merlin. I don't think that bit is super important, but
right.
He finds Merlin in a cave, and Merlin has this animated suit of armor as a guardian. And Lancelot goes into the caves and gives him a potion that will help Merlin wake up. Merlin wakes up and is like, hey, Lancelot, I cast a spell on you to make you immortal. So you'd be here when I got back. You know, let's get to work. We got a world to straighten out. And this is where Lancelot says, look, you know, the world isn't what you thought it was. And, you know, this isn't going to work. And I'm sorry, I can't help you. At which point Merlin reveals he's going to sacrifice him. And so then the turn becomes Lancelot has to defend the world against Merlin and to say, look, I was an idealist too, but I've come to realize the world is a complicated, nuanced place. And I'm here to defend the good and the bad parts of the world. And I'm actually Camelot's last defender. That's why the story is named, because I'm going to protect it from the worst tyrant of all, you, the simple idealist. So,
right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that title kind of like hinging on like that Camelot's more complicated, you know, if you lived there, it was much more complicated. And like, it stands for all of these good things, but it also like, it stands for all the things that it fell short of. And in some ways, you know, like Merlin is the actual, you know, architect and therefore last defender of Camelot against, you know, this kind of disillusioned Lancelot. And I think that's a really interesting kind of, that is the whole, teeter totter of this story.
Yeah. The whole thing, Lancelot, Morgana tells Lancelot, look, the Grail, not a real thing. It was an illusion by Merlin to get you guys pumped and to give you guys some inspiration, but it never really existed. And that's why you're never going to find it. And that's when he wants to like almost leave the room, which is, I think, just an incredible moment. But that whole I would like to talk about the gameability for a second, because I think there actually is some in here. I think there is a wonderful way that you can incorporate these sort of larger myths into your game. So, for example, running into Lancelot or Morgan Le Fay or Merlin could be like if you're running a game. So what he did, what Roger Zelazny does that I like, and we'll talk about this more after, but he modernizes old myths. He wrote a lot of science fiction and projects a lot of myths into the future. His first book, Lord of Light, which he won the Hugo for, it's about these people who have visited a more primitive planet. So they take on the guises of the Hindu pantheon, and the Lord of Light is the sort of Buddha character in this story. But it's a science fiction story set in the future, and these are all people using science fiction to sort of science to create superpowers to appear godlike. So there's always this modernization aspect to his stories that I really like. So the gameable bit, right, is to take one of these myths and sort of draw it into the future. And I think there's a very fun idea of putting, you know, a character from myth and dropping it into your game. Even if your game is like D&D, I once played in a game of Dragon Quest where somebody dropped in Robin Hood, essentially. Mm-hmm. And of course, Robin Hood was the best of anybody. But like we learned bare knuckle fighting from him, and he was sort of a larger than life NPC in the character. So you can sort of draw these characters into your game and have fun with them. They just can't be the sort of central aspect of it, I think.
Yeah. And I have one quick digression on Lord of Light. Is it was going to be adapted into a movie. And in fact, one of the concept artists for that movie was Jack Kirby.
Yes.
Yes. Who would later go on to do a little comic book called The Eternals, which is essentially the same idea.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a very, very Chariot of the Gods kind of like was out there in the zeitgeist and everything like that. So I'm not saying that he stole the idea from Zelazny or anything. I think there was lots of people kind of talking about the possibility of aliens being the foundation of our own myths and all that kind of stuff. But,
right.
And then they actually more recently in 2012 released a film called Argo that is a based on actual events of the CIA using a Hollywood production scouting locations for this proposed movie of Lords of Light to solve Iranian hostage crisis.
I had no idea. That's
there
great.
You go. So it's all connected to Zelazny and Jack Kirby after all. So
that's amazing. And you love Jack Kirby, so
yeah, I adore Jack Kirby.
When are we going to read some early Jack Kirby as part of your inspiration, dude?
You know, we'll do it. The thing is, I would have to choose the Kirby that would be the most gameable. And I don't quite know what that would be off the top of my head. But,
yeah, because the really crazy stuff is not gameable at all. But like the Fantastic Four, everybody knows about. So yeah, it's hard to.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But back to your point, like the idea of taking these mythological characters, like I think it would be an amazing game of D&D set in the Forgotten Realms. Is if to solve this puzzle, you have to go wake up Mordenkainen, you know, from the sleep, right? You know, like if you have to go talk to Tasha, and then when they wake up, they actually turn out just like, what's going on? Is everything fixed yet? No? Okay, all right, let's do it. And then you realize you have to kind of like, you have to kind of off this old guy before he like becomes a worse problem.
That's interesting. From a gaming standpoint, I have this question because some of my favorite fiction does that, right? Like it says, it says like we're trying to solve a problem, and in solving like if you watch the plot of the new D&D movie trailer, like that's literally the plot. Like on an adventure, we stole something for somebody. Oops, we stole something for somebody really bad, and now they can take over the world. I love those plots. How do you think a player likes those plots? Like pulling the rug out a little bit to say, oh, you succeeded in your mission and now all of the undead in the world are going to arise. Good work. Now you've got to fix that. Like, I think it's great, but I wonder how players feel about it.
I don't know. Because I'm a forever GM. I would adore it. I don't know what your average like fifth edition enjoyer player would find fun about that. But I don't worry about it too much. When I have questions of my players in my fifth edition game now, which is probably one of my favorite games I've run ever, and it's all because of the group and not necessarily because of anything else. But like when I'm just like, hey, we're at kind of like this point, we're like ending 10 minutes ahead of time. Let's just talk about like, what do we want in the game that you feel like isn't happening right now? Like what moving forward, what kinds of things do we want to matter in this story that we're building together? So like, you know, if I feel like something's not working, I'll just bring it up out of character. I do not feel this great pressure to have every single thing happen in fiction and then just like look at their eyes when I drop the bombs to see if it worked or not. You know, it's like, I'll talk to people about it.
Yeah. I think a lot of problems could be solved in, well, most things, but let's just keep it to gaming. If we just like getting, getting consent before you start for anything that's particularly weird and then evaluating afterwards to see how everything went. Yeah.
I think, most cultural issues in Dungeons & Dragons or any game that you're running could be solved just by talking about your game like you're all ordering a pizza that everybody needs to agree with, right?
Yes.
You know, it's just like, hey, if you don't eat meat, everybody needs to know that before we put in our order, you know? And it's like, if that means we need to have a separate pizza or something like that, like, you know, we will figure that out. But if we can all just kind of like chill out and collaborate on creating this thing that everybody needs to enjoy at least a little bit of, we'd be better off. But
yeah, I agree. So let's go back to this story now that we've done a little bit of gamification. So, do we want to talk a little bit about Zelazny? And I could say more about the story. I enjoy the suit of animated armor, but it's just sort of a MacGuffin to give Lancelot somebody to fight. Yeah. I enjoy Morgan Le Fay here as the truth teller and the one who ultimately defeats Merlin, right? She holds him in this sort of magical other dimension so that he can't come back to Earth. And therefore, you know, she actually solves the problem.
And I think actually like Morgana is like the best part of this story. I love the heel turn that, you know, it turns out Merlin's the bad guy, but it really only kind of works on that one level where I feel like a lot of the depth of the story and like the cleverness of the looking at this myth from a modern perspective, where that's really accomplished is in Morgana's fortune telling shop at the beginning of the story. Yeah. Because
she breaks all of his illusions. She's the truth teller. She suggests he go back to England. Like, she's the driver of the story and a great character. Like, you also like her very much too.
Yeah. And she's doing a fantastic job kind of saying like, hey, you know, all this stuff that you thought was like good was a little fashy, you know, like, you know, Merlin did a bunch of stuff like that causes problems for people. And like, I had to exist in that world where I wasn't really allowed to have a destiny that wasn't opposed to Camelot, right? Like, I didn't, you know, like I could not assimilate into that world, and therefore I was cast as a villain, and that didn't make me feel good. And the world's a better place now that Camelot doesn't exist and people aren't treating each other that way.
And in fact, he goes on to suggest that Arthur, more in a sort of modern sense, that Arthur is more maybe a willing sort of not that smart tool for Merlin.
Yeah.
And that Merlin was the mover and shaker of everything. And he didn't want it to be like something we remember forever as an ideal. He wanted it to be like an empire that lasted the generations. And it didn't work. Yeah.
Yes. Merlin was trying to fix the world through the right of kings, through military might, and men in shining suits of armor telling everybody what to do. And he was just like, okay, well, let's just do that again.
yeah,
in the year, you know, in the year 19XDX, like, you know, like,
yeah,
let's get the round table back together. And I think that kind of that is such an interesting idea, and it really kind of causes, I think that also points to, you know, there's a strong element, this wistful element of you can never go home again. Like, you know, yes, like you, the only reason you enjoyed certain things so much when you were a kid was because you were ignorant of like how, you know, how that was actually interfacing with other dialogues and all this kind of stuff.
Yes.
But yep, there's also this idea that, like, you know, we don't, when we're playing Dungeons and Dragons, we frequent, like, if it actually came down to, like, if the king says, like, hey, go solve this little problem, it's like, oh, sure, no problem. Pay me.
Right.
You know? But then if it's like, hey, I need you to go assassinate someone who seems like they could have an equal claim to the throne. Like,
right,
you're not going to do that. Like, no D&D party is going to be like, sure, king, we will prop up your, you know, we will prop up this, you know, kind of the royal lineage in this way for sure. Absolutely. I think everybody would be like, wait, huh? This seems like a bad idea. So like a lot of the things about like medieval society don't actually gel with our kind of like two-fisted
modern morals,
rock'em sock'em, you know, D&D play style.
Yeah, and additionally, like, I think also what this story gave me permission to do is introduce a little moral ambiguity into the game, you know, and I think that can, in my current Vassin game, for example, like there's a dragon, but the real conflict is between two brothers, one of whom has become sort of consumed by the lust for the dragon's gold, and you know, the party has had to steal this gold from him to try and reunite these brothers, and the dragon is sort of incidental. You know what I mean? So,
yeah,
and I didn't come up with this plot, but it made me more comfortable with the more gray stories that I think we enjoy running a little bit more as we get a little older. Right.
I think that, and that is something that this story does really well. It's just like, there's, it's not necessarily about good guy versus bad guy. It's about what people want to happen coming into conflict with one another.
Yes.
And some people have good points and some people have bad points, and it's always going to be some kind of mixture. But here in this moment, you know, it's just like, it seems clear to Lancelot that, like, when he finds out that Morgana's still alive, he doesn't just, like, you know, like put her to death. But once it becomes clear that, like, oh wait, all that stuff we were doing back then is like, it would be bad if we did that now, is something that Lancelot's like, I have to stop you. I can't let this happen. It's like it comes to a point in a very natural way, because of some of the revelations he has talking to this character that was once just like recognized and categorized safely as villain, where their point of view could not infect his worldview. And yes, he doesn't have that luxury because he's been looking at art for the last 1,000 years.
Well done, Kyle. Perfect.
Ah, yeah, there it is.
Well, let's take a minute. Let's talk about Roger Zelazny for a second, because he's also an opposite of Wagner's. Though he also died a little young, he died in 95 as well, I believe, of lung cancer. He was a lifelong smoker. So he did, I mean, I guess it was technically substance abuse, but not in the same. He was a big coffee drinker and smoker, and it just caught up with him. But he was older than Wagner. I think he was in his 60s. His children were grown. And he wrote a set of beloved novels called the Amber series, that people really enjoy. But the reason I bring those up is that they are also great because they do this great combination of modernity and fantasy tropes. And that's why they're really good. So at the beginning of the Amber novels, one of the characters wakes up with amnesia in a mental institution in upstate New York. And he doesn't know what's going on, but he's pretty sure he shouldn't be there. And as the story unravels, he finds out that he's not just anybody. He's actually part of this crazy royal family that sort of rules the universe, and they're all immortal, and they live in this place called Amber. But rather than being these sort of benevolent, lovely beings, they're all sort of very human and petty, and modernity plays a big part in it. And he does a good job balancing sort of modernity and fantasy. So for example, one of the plot points, spoiler, if you're going to read Amber, is gunpowder doesn't work in Amber. Amber's the only sort of one true world. So the reason people still run around with swords and capes and mail is that you can't use guns until our character figures out a way to make him work in Amber. And that tilts the balance of the fantasy world versus modernity. And he's, you know, smoking and swearing, and like, he's very much a modern person. And a lot of the story is sort of split in the Amber books between him like living a life on Earth as a regular person and being this prince of this illustrious kingdom. And one of the best moments is one of his friends, Bill, is a lawyer, and they just like, it's like they're like neighbors, and he has beer with Bill, but at one point late in the story he shows up at Bill's house on a horse, like wearing the crown, because he's like taken over the throne of this kingdom, and Bill's like, promise me when we're done with this you'll come back and buy me a beer and explain all this to me, like you know, like so there's this sort of pleasure in, and it sort of brings into question, like, as a modern person reading fantasy, almost you feel kind of silly. I mean, I don't, but I know some people think it's silly, and it's just such a great way of combining the two, like modern people in a fantasy setting that I really enjoy.
And I think it is really interesting because you get this sense that both Zelazny and Herbert have this strong sense of aesthetic. Like, this is the thing that I want this place to look like. I want people to be sword fighting, and I want sword fighting to make sense, even though they have all this impossible technology. And so it sounds like both Amber and Dune have kind of like this lampshade of like this reason why people aren't just blasting away with machine guns or laser beams all the time. It's because, like, actually everybody has these personal shields, or actually this dimension doesn't allow for those kinds of rules to occur.
Yes. And you'll notice even in this story, like Zelazny has always been meticulous to explain why his world works the way it does. Yes. Even here, right? Like, at one point, Merlin says, oh, Lancelot, I turned off the spell that was keeping you young, and now you're going to age quickly and you can no longer defeat me. And Lancelot runs back into the cave to get his walking stick and sneaks a bit of the potion that rejuvenated Merlin, but he doesn't tell him till later. Right. So every sort of bit, like, he doesn't miss a bit. His plots are very tightly structured. And, you know, if there's a gun in the, you know, first act, it's going to go off by the third act. He's very meticulous about that kind of plotting. And in fact, Amber's famous for its plot, because the point of Amber is, all right, who's really the mover and the shaker? There's all these brothers and you don't know who's doing it. And then you find out. And then he sort of goes backwards and explains this, then this, then this, you know. So if you like that sort of book, it's good. And he does that very well.
And especially in terms of Defenders, Last Defender of Camelot, it because of its kind of brief nature and fairly like contained set pieces, it seems like it would make the most natural, like, you know, teleplay adaptation ever. And in fact, it was in the 80s adapted to the Twilight Zone, one of the various colorized routes. And you know who is credited as writing the screenplay as one George R. R. Martin.
You know what, I have a thought about that, but finish your statement and I will say something about that.
And he absolutely destroys all of the subtlety that is in it. He just mangles it. Oh, it's terrible.
It's funny.
Astonishing. That is funny. I watched it last night during a bubble bath, and it was a wonderful way to feel like this kind of like artistic outrage while soaking in the suds. It was a wonderful time.
I will say, I'll put it in the show notes. They were friends, those two. And Zelazny was an old hand when George was breaking into the business. And there's a remembrance on R. Martin's website for Roger Zelazny that is just very loving. Like, Roger didn't have to be my friend, and he was, and like he would go to his monthly lunch with all like the famous writers that lived around, you know, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he would bring me along as if I was one of the gang. And it's a really nice remembrance. Also included in that remembrance is the fact that in his last couple years of life, Roger Zelazny discovered role-playing games and started playing them with his partner, Jane Linscold, and loved them. So I just want to throw that out there too, as something fun.
That's incredible. Yeah. And also, like, you know, I enjoy slagging off a very successful and well-known writer for this.
But everybody's got
this one
somewhere.
Random teleplay. But also, it's like, I have no idea what the writing conditions and like what the editorial stipulations were for this particular project, all this kind of stuff. Right. But I would say, like, I do think that it is worth it is worth watching only if you have actually read the original thing, because like they have this really interesting conversation between each other. But we, you know, that is far beyond the remit, I think, of this, yes, this program.
So we started really hot here about some very different ideas about art and sort of intention and those kind of things. Do we want to jump into those, or do we think we're good and we want to save those for another time?
No, I think
said
that's good.
Things that made your hair stand up on end.
And... Yeah, no, well, I think now that I'm really thinking about this, this is certainly a deconstructionist take on
the Arthur legend.
On the Arthur legend, absolutely. In the same way,
he ends it with the words from I believe they're from
L'Amour d'Arthur.
Yeah, the death of Lancelot. So he, at the same time, he's tipping his hat to it, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, he clearly, I do really think that this is a wistful, you know, like man cast in about the same age that Lancelot would have been at the time. You know, you get the sense, this is very like longing for a simpler time, kind of Ray Bradbury gesture at the whole thing.
Yes.
But it is like, you know, it's like, I adore these things, but we cannot take them untransformed into and say that they work. And I quick shout out to my friend, David, who actually gave me a call in response to our last episode.
Oh, he called you. Oh my gosh.
He called me.
Was it a rage call? He's like, I have to call Kyle right now.
I don't know that David is capable of rage. He's one of the sweetest and most generous human beings I've ever met. But he did kind of have this point where it's just like, we were kind of decrying the kind of hackneyed nature of the damsel in distress trope. So this would have been in response to our Wagner, Dark Muse, Night Songs thing. And he's like, I think that there's something valuable about that, that like that people and young men specifically need to know that they are supposed to go protect people and things that are important to them and come to the rescue of people who need help. I don't think that this, I think this trope has served humanity well for, you know, thousands of years. This idea of like, you know, a call to action to go like take care of business. And I think he has a pretty interesting point. And I think that there is also like a nod to that, that there is, that it's, you know, that Zelazny is kind of saying like, it's not like there's nothing valuable about these old stories,
right,
but we need to continue to complicate them and nuance them as society advances, as we kind of think about, as we think about things differently, like we need to be careful about how these stories are going transformed through time.
Right.
As opposed to just ordering it, you know, neat every time and just taking it straight from, you know, the way it comes. I think that's something that Zelazny is doing here, which I, as a dungeon master, think about frequently, and as a content creator, you know, as one of these muckety muck talking heads about Dungeons and Dragons, I also think about that as well. It's just like, you know, taking some of the original text of and presumptions of Dungeons and Dragons and bringing them untransformed into 2022 is sort of a bad idea. But that doesn't mean that we just throw the baby out with the bathwater. So that was what I took away from this irate phone call from David, and then also from this story as well. So yeah.
And remember, the world is a better place in some ways and worse in others. There are many ways of making life easier, and the sum total of human knowledge has increased vastly. How has it worsened? There are many more people, consequently more people are suffering from poverty, disease, and ignorance. The world has suffered a great depredation. Wars? There's always someone fighting somewhere. Then they need help. Maybe, and maybe not. Thank you.
Splatbook is a proud part of Roll For It Media. Be sure to check out our sister show, Roll For Topic, wherever fine podcasts are purveyed or on their website, gmdiscussions.com. And please leave us a 5-star review on your podcasting app of choice. It really helps us out. You can follow me on Twitter at Kyle Latino. My YouTube channel is MapCrow, and you can subscribe to my Patreon at patreon.com/MapCrow. And you can follow John in your hearts. Our intro music was a track called Sir Lancelot and the Black Knight from the Myths and Legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table, recorded in 1975 and composed by Rick Wakeman. And our outro music was the 1985 theme to The Twilight Zone by the Grateful Dead, of all people, with the assistance of Merle Saunders. Stay tuned for some cut bitlets.
Yes, yes, excellent. Okay, so let me pull up my notes here so we can get started. My goodness. I'm excited to talk about this. I am fairly baffled as to like why this fits into your appendix N, because it is that's just the podcast though. Like I can't start talking about that now, but
that's right. That's right. I can tell you. Are you blonde or redheaded?
I think that I'm blonde,
you look like
but
a
I have
redhead
been
today.
Today, well, I have a very red. I have a very red beard.
It's your beard.
But also, I have people tell me that I'm not blonde, and I'm like, why are you telling me this? Like, I hate it when people acknowledge I have a physical existence. I would prefer that people refer to me as an invisible storm cloud of fury and artistic talent.
Yes,
that would be my preference. But
well, that's
but
what the internet's for. Yeah.
Right, exactly. That's I can be this disembodied pair of hands that just narrates things on MapCrow. And then, yes, also podcasting, so I can...
Well,
I
yeah,
can
so yeah, your this. Beard is very red, so maybe you're just actually revealing to me today that you're Kane the Mystic Swordsman, who's lived all this time, and you're now revealing yourself to me, finally.
Welcome to Splatbook. Well, that was very loud. Welcome to Splatbook, the
Oh, here we are.
Oh, welcome all to right. Splatbook, the RPG
okay,
Topics podcast.
All right. I'm
you
good.
Got this. You got the sillies out.
I'm getting sillies out. Ready? Go. Hold on. Here, John, cut this long pause out.
That is the grodiest paperback I have seen in a long time.
Don't you love it?
It is so yellow and filthy.
Oh yeah, this is my original.
It's
this
like,
paperback
it's like
is 40 years
blowing
old, bro.
Cigarette smoke directly into it for the last.
Well, the yellow is on purpose. Like it was printed, the edges were yellow. But yes, anyway. That's weird. What I want to say is, I know that here's what I'm trying to look up. Roger Zelazny, one of his books, and I think it was Lord of Light, beat Dune for the Hugo Award. And I want to look up the details of that before I spout them out. Oh no, it was even worse. I got it. All right, so I'm ready to go back to talking if you are.
Go for it.
So Roger Zelazny, one of his first books, 1965, This Immortal, which is also called And Call Me Conrad, tied for the Hugo Award, which is the most popular novel, to a little known tract by Frank Herbert called Dune. So just think of your time frame, like that's where Roger Zelazny sort of fits in the timeline and is coming from. But and I forgot the point I was going to make. What were we even talking?
You were talking about Lord of Light.
And they take on the guises of the Indian gods from history. Let me just start over here because I'm losing my mind. It's not Buddhism. It's the Hinduism, the Hindu pantheon.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. I will probably play that version of the Twilight Zone ending theme for our own exit outro music, because I won't be able to help myself.
Yeah. Hey, there's, you know what? I forgot there was another thing I wanted to read to you. It's in a different book. I'm going to run and get it.
Please
and
do.
Come back. All right.
And, you know, while John is gone, I'll just say this, that David and I go way back and I love him to bits. And none of the rest of you knuckleheads out there can just like call me up and disagree with my takes on this show. All right. That is purely a David thing. I don't want to normalize this like direct like bat phone hotline to Splatbook. The splat phone. Okay, no, I'm really thinking about this now. If I set up a voicemail machine. If I can figure out how to set up a voicemail machine, we might just have like a splat phone now. I've talked myself into it. I've done a complete 180. I love this idea. And mostly because of the name. Mostly because of the name splat phone. Is so close to bat phone that we have to do this. John's back, so I have to.
Who are you talking to?
I was just talking to our listeners, John. So that's a little gift for editing, John.
Yeah, thanks. Here's a picture of a fish my son drew for me that I've been using as a bookmark for 10 years.
Oh, that's a very nice fish. The snack that smiles back. Yeah.
So there's a, there was, I think, Green Knight Publishing, and I believe they were part of Paizo, but I couldn't swear to it, released some original fiction about Camelot. Hmm. This one is Legends of the Pendragon. There's a story here where it's Merlin teaching a young Arthur how to solve a problem. And there's a river that he wants him to dam, but the dam kills some other creatures that he didn't intend to kill. And he gets really mad at Merlin for giving him an unfair test. And the point of this story is that Merlin is Prometheus, but that's not what I wanted to say. What I wanted to say... Here it is, and I'll just read this to you. So this is a different take on Merlin and Arthur. So in this story, Merlin is telling Arthur about the story of Prometheus and how Prometheus decided to betray his fellows and didn't warn them, and it caused the end of the Titans. And he's asking Merlin about his ability to see the future, and he says, "So Merlin, you have no effect on the future that you see either?" "None," said Merlin. "So what is the point then?" "You learn to trust, Arthur," Merlin said, stroking his beard. It was rare that he used Arthur's real name, and I sat down on the ground before him, transfixed. "You have to trust that the world is turning in the way that it should, and that you have been set in your proper place in it. I have that trust now, because now is the time when I am supposed to have that trust. But someday, that trust will waver again, but that day is not today. The secret is to not stop caring about what is going on around you, even if you know the outcome in advance. This is the lesson of the ants, Arthur, that there's no way that you could have saved them. That didn't mean that you shouldn't have felt sorry for them, understood their pain, or stayed with them until the disaster, the one you'd known was coming all along, overtook them." We were silent again for a long time, and then Merlin reached out and clasped my shoulder. "There will come a time, young Arthur, many years in the future, when you will think the worst of me. When that time comes, I want you to remember this lesson, the lesson of the ants." In any case, I always was really moved by that little piece right there.
I think that's a quiet great moment. Yeah. There is something that is like truly wonderful about the relationship of Merlin and Arthur. Yeah. I think it comes out really, really well at the beginning of The Once and Future King by T.H. White.
Yes.
And there's this great thing, because they basically do the whole, like, you know, the Disney version, The Sword and the Stone, is an adaptation of the early parts of The Once and Future King.
Right.
So all that bit where Merlin and Boy Arthur are like transforming into all these different animals and learning all these complicated lessons, right? Yeah. That's like the best part of the book, in my opinion. But there's this bittersweet moment once you get past that and Merlin comes back into Arthur's life when Arthur's an adult. He's like, hey, so do you remember all those crazy adventures we went on when we were like squirrels and fish and birds and stuff? And Arthur was like, no, not really. And it's just like, yeah, that's how it's supposed to go. But it really hurts to hear that. And, you know, that there's a strong comment about like the coming of age of, you know, this sort of like hero's journey thing about the, you know, the role of the apprentice and the magician and the wise man kind of like leading men through this difficult process of like understanding that the world is complicated and that they have to be empathetic with, you know, people and creatures that are nothing like themselves. So to build the empathetic creativity in order to do that is like a key element in the education of Arthur. And essentially, you know, they were just, you know, Merlin and Arthur at the beginning of Once and Future King were just LARPing as different creatures to understand.
You've just blown my mind that the idea here is that the idea of that story is to create empathy and understand that the world is complicated. And, you know, in the example that I just read, Arthur was doing a task that Merlin set him. It ended up in the destruction of an ant colony, and Arthur's mad at Merlin for making that happen. And Merlin's saying, look, it's not that simple, you know?
Yeah. But it is important to feel about it. It is important for those complicated feelings to not give in to nihilism, to always err on the side of empathy and compassion, which is also, you know, a strong element of that comes up in Last Defenders of Camelot. It's just and almost like I suspect that the story you just read is in conversation with like all of these various versions of Merlin, and sometimes he's a real and sometimes he's wonderful, right? And it's just like, hey, I'm not always going to be myself. I'm not always going to kind of like from Doctor Who, you know, it's like, I'm not always going to be exactly the same person in these stories. But right now, I'm telling you, this is what's important. Don't lose track of that. And this is really cool. As a side note, I wish there was some way that every time you assigned a story that you could just record the whole thing, because you have a wonderful reading voice.
Oh, thanks. I've often thought that like if that were legal and there were non-copyrighted things we could read, I would do that, because I enjoy reading aloud to people. One of my joys as a parent actually was reading a lot of stories to my kids, because I love it.
I can tell. Like, I mean, that comes across. Like, you do an excellent job with it. But for the record, Dunsany is all in the public domain. So
I know. I should record a... yes. And I've learned... I have also a new love of audiobooks, which I didn't have before.
Yeah, that is...
And I love an actor who can read an audiobook as multiple characters and make it really good.
Yes, that is key to my enjoyment of long form literature.
And I know you're not. I'll shill Stephen King. There's an actor named Will Patton, who read a series of Stephen King stories that feature this one woman, Holly Gibney, who is sort of she has a bit of autism around the edges, and she's very insecure. So the two characters in this book is like this tough as nails, confident retired police detective and Holly. And to see this actor pivot from, you know, the police detective who's a no nonsense to Holly's voice, which is very hesitant and perhaps not always the most confident, is like, I, you know, he's like, I'm a sucker for it. He like, this actor has made me fall in love with this sort of very complicated, insecure, wonderful character that Stephen King created.
To portray chemistry when it's just a single actor is, think, a very difficult thing to manage. But
there are some people now that I will read their, I will listen to their books even if I don't like their books, because I like the actor. Ooh. Like Will Patton is one. If you look up Will Patton, you'll recognize him. He's one of that guy, but he's also like a really talented actor. And there's another woman, Imogen Church, who does these mystery novels that I don't even like the novels that much anymore, but she's English and she does English men in this hilariously deep voice. And it's really, she's amazing. It cracks me up every time.
I think the reader for Mr. Strange and Dr. Gnarl, I forget the exact title of that, but did an excellent job. It's a very, very long book, but like, you know, the voice for the man with the thistle down hair is something that really, like, I bring that into my games. I love doing that voice. I think we constantly deal with this like anxiety of just like, are we actually just like too in love with this stuff? And I think the answer is no. I think there's too much irony in the world and we are the antidote.
I think so too. This is what I was thinking about. Like, there was yet another debate on the Discord about how to run games and safety nets for games and stuff. And what I always want to scream at people is like, the reason I argue the way I do is not because I think I'm right. It's because I know there's other people out there like me and how uncool it is to be that way. And I want them to hear this podcast and be like, well, I'm really earnest and I like to improvise and be silly and also have really earnest moments. And I like to RPG and I'm not a math wizard, you know, like, and I want to, part of that is me trying to make space for them. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is what we do on this show. Although sometimes it puts us into an awkward position of actually stating what we feel, which is tough to do. Tough to do in 2022, you know?
It is. Yeah. So